Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Paul Haywood, the author and columnist, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. Who needs a Super League when you've got the Champions League semi-finals of such intensity and unpredictability? Liverpool seem capable of protecting a two-goal lead in Villarreal, but no one can say with any certainty what will transpire in the Bernabeu on Wednesday. Manchester City have a slender 4-3 lead over Real Madrid. Now, last week's game was gloriously chaotic, Adrian. But as far as City are concerned, you know, they've got a patchy history in this competition. Is the curse of the Champions League about to strike again?
It could, absolutely. And it shouldn't. It shouldn't. We shouldn't even be talking about Manchester City place in the final being under threat, because they are, I think, in almost every respect, significantly better than Real Madrid. And they could have won that game 8-3, couldn't they? It was a bonkers game, absolutely glorious to watch. But they've allowed Real Madrid into it, haven't they? And we saw what their amazing talent and belief can do in that match. And I think the fact that they're still in the tie, Real Madrid, will give them an even greater belief that it's their destiny to see off Manchester City and to reach the final this season. But yeah, I think that Manchester City will have an awful lot of regrets about A, their finishing, and B, the way that they defended against Real Madrid at times in that contest. It was great to watch, but I'd imagine that Pep wasn't happy.
Yeah, you know, let's be honest here, Paul. You know, we're going to be part of this. Well, we are part of this by even talking in this way. You know, a lot's going to be made of City's record as nearly men in the Champions League. I suppose the question is, do they have the collective mental strength to ignore all that white noise which is going to be around them?
Yeah, I certainly think they have the mental strength, and they will keep reminding themselves that they are ahead in the tie. But what they don't have is that ruthlessness, that sort of clinical edge that Liverpool have. And it will prey on their minds, I think, that they should have put Real Madrid away in the first leg. And there are a number of City players, you know, who were guilty of, again, that lack of ruthlessness around the penalty area. It's a pattern you've seen in Manchester City all season. They get away with it because they create so many chances. They've got so many good players. In the end, they overwhelm teams, really, without having the clinical edge that really, really great sides have. But Real Madrid will have noticed that, and it will have encouraged them. And City, as Aid said, will just be thinking, hang on, we've slightly messed this up once, and now the pressure's on us not to mess it up again.
When you think about it, Adrian, you know, I think there's, you know, a good body of opinion which says that Kevin De Bruyne is the best midfield player in the world. I think one thing that gets overlooked is his experience. You know, he's the only survivor, for instance, from that goalless draw in Madrid between the teams in 2016. Is he the key player in this return leg?
I think he is. Yeah, he was outstanding, wasn't he, in the game? And I talked ahead of that match and picked out the midfield of City compared to Real Madrid. And and it's younger, it's more dynamic. I know that Kevin De Bruyne isn't young, but it's fitter, it's faster, it's stronger than the engine room of Real Madrid, who obviously, as a nod to that, they left out Casemiro, didn't they, and put in Valverde. They changed things around a little bit. But even so, City did slice through the middle of the pitch with great frequency, particularly in that first half an hour. And De Bruyne was at the heartbeat of everything. He is a sensational player. And I don't think Real Madrid have got anyone in their side that can live with him if he brings his A game on the night. But Kevin De Bruyne alone can't carry Manchester City to the Champions League final. They also have to find a way to cope with Benzema and Vinicius Jr. because we know Pep is all about us. It's how we play. We'll score more than you. But I think there has to be a little bit more focus on denying those two star players for Real Madrid the opportunity to hurt them. And that might be as pivotal as how De Bruyne performs.
Mm. What about Phil Foden, Paul? You know, I look at him, he still looks about 15. And he, with that haircut, actually, he looks like one of those princes who were imprisoned in the Tower of London in about 1360 or something. Is he on the verge, do you think, of fulfilling, which is obviously a rare talent?
I'm glad you asked me about this, because he's an exceptional talent, and he's going to be potentially one of England's great players. There's a problem, I think, with a young talent, though, in that they reach a point where everybody says, best player since Gascoigne. People stop questioning their development. It's not, you know, you're not allowed anymore to. You have to suspend your critical faculties, and all you can do is heap praise on a guy. And I think that's fundamentally unhealthy, because I still think he's got some developing to do. Mainly, I don't think his composure around the penalty area when he gets finishing opportunities is quite at the level it needs to be for him to become a great player. I think he'll get there, but at the moment, he's occasionally over-eager. There was a case in the first half in that game at the Etihad where City put together this stunning move and swept the ball out to Foden in the kind of inside left channel. And his first touch was really poor, and it carried the ball away from him, and he ended up dragging the shot wide. Mm. And, you know, the trouble is we've reached the point where, as I said, experts in the game aren't really allowed to point that out anymore because, you know, you're having a go at a brilliant, a genius young player. Now, he is a brilliant young player, but I think he's still actually in a developmental phase. He's not far off where he needs to be, but there are parts of his game that he still needs to improve. And the main one is composure around the penalty area.
Yeah, completely agree on that, yeah.
Yeah, while we're you know, taking a knife to a few sacred cows, you know, I'm probably going to get pelters for this, Aid, but there is something, I don't know, there's a missing link in this City team. You know, they're beautiful to watch, but if I'm really honest, they don't emotionally engage me at all in the way that, say, Liverpool do.
Yeah, why is that, do you think?
There is almost like it's almost too clinical,
yeah.
In a strange way.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, they're so good. They're such a well-coached side. They're so technically outstanding that they don't sort of rely on heart and courage and those sort of basic
ingredients. I think it's a difference between science and art.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah,
I like art and all the fallibility that comes with that.
But I also think that we're still coming to terms with City being a major powerhouse in English football, aren't we? Then they never used to be. It's not Liverpool. It's not Manchester United. They're a new club. And I don't think they foster as many emotions for the neutral as, you know, good or bad emotions as one of the institutions of English football. I think it's going to take many more years. I think the younger generation than us will probably feel that more than we do. I think they're glorious to watch. I think we should celebrate how entertaining they are. I really do. But I know what you're saying. I just feel that they're still slightly flawed. I see obvious weaknesses at the back, particularly with those passes in behind the fullbacks down the sides of centre halves, and I still don't think they've really, really cured that. And that's why for me Liverpool have the edge in all of the competitions. It doesn't mean that Liverpool are going to win all four, But I think that Liverpool are the more rounded team of the two.
I think on the balls behind the fullbacks, I'd forgotten really what a significant loss it was to have Walker and Cancelo both missing in that Real Madrid game, because Walker would have given Vinicius Junior a lot less action on that right hand side, Real Madrid's left, and of course he may or may not have got nutmegged in the way that Fernandinho did on the halfway line, but if he had, he'd have caught up with Vinicius because he's so quick, and Cancelo, as we know, is a brilliant player on the other side. So it was a significant handicap for City, I think, to be without those two players in that game.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you know, there's little that Carlo Ancelotti hasn't seen before. You know, he's managed in Champions League semi-finals in over four decades. What do you think Pep's approach to the return will be in a tactical sense, Aid?
Not a lot different. I mean, actually, having said that, I think that if you look at Manchester City in the Premier League this season on the road, they've controlled matches really well. They've kept an awful lot of clean sheets. They've got the best defensive record, actually, on their travels in the Premier League, Manchester City. So there's a lot to be said. I think they're slightly less gung-ho away from the Etihad than they are on their own patch. But ultimately, I think that he will be looking at that Real Madrid midfield and defence. You know, particularly, I think, Real Madrid's fullbacks as well. They struggled badly, didn't they? Carvajal is a clear weak link that other teams have identified this season in the Champions League. And I think he'll look to exploit them. No, it'll be, we're going to outscore you. I think that's the approach.
What about Ancelotti? He says something which struck me, Paul, after the first leg, which was, as I said, you know, gloriously chaotic, wasn't it? His quite direct quote was, "This team, these players are able to not lose their minds." That's perfect for knockout football, isn't it?
It really is. And let's not forget, they were 3-0 down at home to Chelsea in the previous round and still came through that. I think they were 3-0 down until the 75th minute, weren't they? And they their ability to stay calm and to focus and use their experience is exactly what Ancelotti is talking about. And that came to their rescue again in Manchester, where they could have been really, you know, taken to the cleaners by City. I must say, I do admire this Real Madrid team for its ability to stay in a game and to come back and to use all their quality and experience. And, of course, the player that's pivotal to that is Benzema, because Benzema will keep doing his thing. He'll wait, he'll pounce on you. He's been scoring brilliant goals. He's been the star of these Champions League knockout rounds, and I suppose City fans are looking at the return leg and thinking and just hoping he doesn't have another one of those games. I mean, he just always seems to have those games in Europe at the moment, so you can't assume that he's not going to hurt them again.
Definitely, yeah. Disappointment doesn't fluster this Real Madrid team, does it? And that's the key to success, because in football, you're going to trail, you're going to have bad patches, bad moments in games, and it's being able to sort of park that and not change and not panic. And yeah, only the very best teams and players can do that, I think. And they've certainly got the ability, but player for player, the City are stronger, in my opinion. And as a collective, as a team, I still think City are way superior, but it doesn't mean they'll go through.
Yeah. Yeah, the Bernabeu is one of my favourite stadiums, Paul. I don't know about you. Could you give the listeners, you know, you've been there on the biggest occasions as well. What's the feeling of that stadium? You know, has it got a spirit of its own?
Oh, it definitely has. From the minute you get off the plane, you know you're going somewhere special. You know, you walk out of your hotel door and the walk to the ground has this resonance about it, and it there it is in front of you, this you know, this sort of cathedral, this repository of all this great history, all those European Cup wins, those shirts, the kits, the fans, the place just has an aura. It's got this regal aura, and the minute you walk through the gate, you just know you're in the kind of heartland of something very special. Whatever your feelings about Real Madrid are, you know, you're in one of the absolute epicenters of world football, And any team that walks in there knows that it has to cope with that, and the steep stands and the noise the crowd makes and the lights and everything's very radiant about it. So I admire any player that can walk onto that pitch against Real Madrid and keep their nerve and think straight, because it can't be easy.
Chelsea did, didn't they? For the most part. Yeah, they did. Really confident.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, as unfair as it might seem, Aid, are we edging towards the suspicion, at least, that there is this chance that City could end up this season, you know, empty-handed, certainly in Europe?
Well, of course they could. Yeah, it's not easy. They've got Liverpool chasing them in the Premier League. They've got two big obstacles to get past to win the Champions League. So yeah, it's they could end up trophyless, but they're still a great side, aren't they? They're still brilliant to watch. I can't be too critical of them, because they're up against an unbelievable opponent in Liverpool. And in this tie, they're up against an unbelievably durable opponent in Real Madrid, aren't they? So if they were to go out to Real Madrid, if they were to finish second to Liverpool, I couldn't sit here and slate Manchester City, because I think they've still had a great season in many respects. But, you know, they're up against, you know, elite opposition. I think we have to take that into that account.
Mm. Liverpool also in Spain, Paul. Villarreal protecting a two-goal lead. I'm expecting a bit of a throwback occasion. You know, I love the community nature of that football club. I think it's fantastic that the tickets start at €10 for a game of that magnitude. How good's that? We do need clubs like Villarreal, don't you? And it's difficult, isn't it? Because you want to say how much you admire them, but you almost come across as being a bit patronising when you do that.
Yeah, you do, I suppose. I mean, them knocking out Bayern Munich was poetry, really, isn't it? In some ways, you know, it was the ultimate sort of, and the disbelief on the face of Bayern Munich when they got knocked out by Villarreal was something to behold. And yet, again, it's a measure of Liverpool's quality that Villarreal went to Anfield with such a, let's say, conservative game plan. And then when you looked at the players, two sets of players on a piece of paper side by side, you really saw how Villarreal are more than the sum of their parts. Individually, they were all outgunned. And many of them were players who'd come to the Premier League and it hadn't quite worked out for them, gone back to Spain and been organised and improved expertly there. But really, in the end, the quality, the difference in quality between those two sets of players was so obvious at Anfield. And they need a kind of miracle, really, to overcome that in the second leg.
Yeah, it looks like they're going to have Gerard Moreno back, who's, a really almost undervalued talent in many ways, although he's a Spanish international. One other player, Foyth. Aid, do you think Spurs let him go too early?
Yeah, I do, actually. Yeah, when you look at his performances in the Champions League this season, not just at Anfield, but in the previous rounds, he was excellent. Really, really impressive. Obviously, he can play in a number of different positions as well. You look at Tottenham, the three at the back formation. You look at the wing-backs as well. He could play wing-back or right-side centre-half and probably be better than what they've got. So, yeah. But he's also benefiting, isn't he, from Unai Emery and the coaching there. I think he's maybe developed and improved him as a player, made him tactically more astute. And he's also playing in a team that's built to stop, isn't he? Against these elite sides, Villarreal are primarily defensive. And so he's offered a lot more protection than he was maybe in the Premier League. But yeah, I think Spurs wouldn't mind him back right now.
Yeah. You know, on that point, Paul, I thought there was a really puzzlingly sour reaction to their performance at Anfield. You know, here's a club with a quarter of Liverpool's budget, an impeccably organised team. You know, yet some people are saying they're a disgrace. I just don't get that.
Well, if they're a disgrace, God help the rest of us. I mean, what were they supposed to do? You know, they obviously thought that was the best hope of getting out of there relatively unscathed. And actually, a 2-0 deficit was them escaping relatively unscathed. I don't blame them for that at all. And of course, we've been spoilt really by we've seen three absolutely epic games in the Champions League knockout phases: Chelsea, Real Madrid, or Real Madrid Chelsea, I should say, Atletico, Man City, and then City, Real Madrid. So, you know, if we're expecting every game to be like that, we're deluding ourselves. A team like Villarreal is entitled to go to Anfield with any game plan it wants to go with, frankly.
Yeah. What about the Liverpool team, and specifically, Aid, the evolution of Sadio Mane this season? You know, he's almost becoming a false nine, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, he's always been able to do that, hasn't he? He's a winger that's really a centre forward. And that's the beauty of this Liverpool forward line. All of the guys can hug the touchline and beat a man, but they can also be a centre forward. And Sadio Mane is that guy. I think what makes him pretty special is his timing. He sees the picture of where the ball is going to end up a little bit quicker than the majority of players in English football, in world football, really. You look at, keep your eye on the runs that he makes. He just anticipates quicker than defenders, and he's able to finish, isn't he, with both feet and his head. He's a really adaptable player. So, yeah, he's got all the tools to be this sort of modern striker that isn't a striker, hasn't he, Sadio Mane? I rate him so highly, but when you've got Jota in there, Salah, and Luis Diaz as well, he's not guaranteed a game, is he? None of us could sit here and say, well, Mane is definitely going to start, because there's a possibility he won't.
At the other end, you know, one of the almost metronomic performances of this season, you know, across the Premier League, across Europe, Virgil van Dijk, Paul, you know, he lost the season essentially last year. He's just been, he's one of these players that you almost don't notice, because he is so efficient and so clinically good.
Yeah, when he injured himself in that game at Everton, I was aghast, really. I kept thinking, God, I hope he comes back to what he's been, because he's such a good player to watch. And if you like good defending, he's the ultimate, really. And I was slightly anxious that he wouldn't come back at his old level. He didn't at first. It took him a while to get back in and judge the pace of the game, and I think establish his confidence and physical authority. But now, as you said, Mike, he's gone back to just pinching the ball off people like he's taking sweets off a child. You know, he just appears. He disappears. He's toying with people again, really. And that ability and exuberance and solidity in defence just spreads itself to the back half of the team. And it must be great playing with him, because he exudes so much confidence.
One other thing is those long diagonals, those early long diagonals. Those players that I just talked about, the strikers, they're getting the ball with better quality and sooner than they did before. It's getting to them so that they've got time to get up ahead of steam and take players on. His distribution is almost as good as his defending, which is remarkable, really, because he's a sensational defender.
Harking back to last Friday, Paul, Mo Salah was announced as the Football Writers Player of the Year. Almost uniquely, I actually backed the winner this year.
Me too.
Yeah. What about you, Paul?
Well, I broke my golden rule, which is that always vote for the best player in the league. And the best player of the league, to me, is Kevin De Bruyne. So I could just vote for him every year quite happily. But at the last minute, something made me introduce a bit of variety into my play. And I went for Declan Rice, because I admire him so much. I quite see that West Ham are, you know, not high enough in the table for you to want to award him for being the best player. But I just like him so much, and I think he's had such a great season. And he's going to be such a great player. I just thought I'd, you know, spread the love a little bit, but I would have been happy with Mo Salah or Kevin De Bruyne winning it equally.
Yeah, I think that's a really good shout, Declan Rice. And, you know, given that West Ham, he will play a key role, as he has throughout the season, Aid, in them trying to come from behind, 2-1 behind in Frankfurt on Thursday. What are his chances of pulling that one off, do you think?
Well, they're up against it, aren't they? They're underdogs, but no one expected West Ham to go to Lyon and play with such sort of authority. So that's the blueprint, isn't it, for them? Just repeat what they produced over there in France against Frankfurt, who did outplay them, I think, in the first leg. It was very impressive, really slick, great movement. And what I felt, my takeaway from that first leg at London Stadium, was that maybe the team got caught up in the emotion of the game, you know, feverish atmosphere. They kind of went away from what's got them there in terms of their solidity and their shape. They got caught on the counter numerous occasions, and that's not David Moyes' West Ham, is it? That doesn't normally happen. So they need to be really careful, and I think they will be. It will be a more pragmatic approach, I would imagine, where they then look to be efficient and nick a goal on the break. They need to be the ones that are on the counter against Frankfurt rather than the other way around, I think.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned you called it the London Stadium Aid. I have to say, I still call it the Olympic Stadium, just as a small protest against the omnipresent West Ham owners who insist that they're a London brand. Having said that, Paul, on that night, and increasingly, actually, to be fair, this season, that stadium has felt like a football ground, hasn't it?
Funny you should mention that, because we're approaching the 10th anniversary of the London 2012 Games. It doesn't feel like 10 years ago, but
wow,
it's taken 10 years really for that stadium to feel like a football ground. Partly through West Ham's own fault, all the turbulence they went through, and you know the unhappiness of the fans and so on. But finally, they look embedded there for the very simple reason that they've got a good team and a good manager to make them feel happy to go there. You know, and so yeah, a decade on from that glorious summer, West Ham have a sort of purpose, an identity, and it's a relief in a way, because that stadium, well, I won't go into the funding of it and the political aspects of it, but it needed to find a use, and it needed to be successful, and maybe it's just, you know, turning a corner now.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about appreciating West Ham as a club, I think you've got to appreciate someone like Mark Noble, Aid. You know, you've been around players who almost embody the football clubs they play for. You know, he's reiterated that he's going to retire at the age of 34. Now, here's a player, he's very grounded, very socially aware, obviously very loyal. Someone like him, has he got a future perhaps in the coaching staff?
I think so. Yeah, I do. He looks the type of guy that should stick around. He needs to be in the game. I really like Mark Noble. I've met him a few times and yeah, enjoy talking to him, and he always comes across so well. He is West Ham. And yeah, hopefully they'll sort of make him part of the coaching staff a little bit, like Michael Carrick was at Manchester United post retirement. He's a really good influence, and I like the strength of sort of his character to say, look, even if we qualify for the Champions League, I'm still retiring. I'm not going to be selfish in that regard, just so that I can have a little taste of it as a player. You know when you know, and I think he realizes it's the right time. And yeah, I understand that he's done his badges. So yeah, I don't think we've heard the last of Mark Noble. And yeah, it might be the case. Obviously, with Steven Gerrard, there's this sort of general feeling that one day he'll manage Liverpool. Mark Noble might have to go away from West Ham and serve his apprenticeship somewhere. But and if he can prove himself, then yeah, maybe he'll end up at West Ham, or he'll just come stay at the club and work his way up through the ranks. But I could certainly see him leading West Ham United as the manager in the future.
Yeah, more immediately Thursday, Paul. You know, you looked at I saw some social media footage of the Eintracht Frankfurt fans going to the game. You know, walking across the park, it was like an invading army. And, you know, they took 30,000 to Barcelona, let's not forget. When they're at home on Thursday, that atmosphere is going to be amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And if Ade is right when he says that the West Ham players maybe got caught up in the emotion of the home leg, then they're certainly going to get caught up potentially in the emotion of what the opposition fans tried to do to them away from home. And of course, West Ham haven't really had a lot of experience on this front. There's a lot of international players in that side who will have played in big international matches, but at club level, this is all uncharted territory for them, and it's going to be difficult for them to keep a cool head. The German fandom is always interesting, is always intriguing. It's got a kind of identity of its own, and I don't know if the players find it intimidating, but I do sometimes.
Yeah. So by contrast, Ibrox on the same evening is going to be quite sedate, isn't it,
No, it's not. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? They've already talked about it. I saw the RB Leipzig head coach was already saying, I can't wait for Ibrox. It's a special stadium. It's iconic. And I think they've got a good away record, haven't they, Leipzig? They'll back themselves. They are overwhelming favourites. I think they're the overwhelming favourites to win this competition, Leipzig. Rangers defended pretty well, I think, by and large. They didn't have that many efforts on goal, Leipzig, but they did miss some real chances. And Nkunku's been terrific for them. Missed an open goal, a couple of other better than half chances as well. So, yeah, Rangers will have to be at their optimum to stand a chance. But the fans, you know that the fans will play their part. You know that they'll make it as intimidating as possible. And yeah, it's helped carry Rangers this far. Maybe they can go again. But if Rangers were to overcome Leipzig, I think it would be an extraordinary achievement.
Yeah, that likely, Paul, given, you know, I think we need to take a step back and really praise Rangers for getting this far in a competition which is really proving itself this year, isn't it?
Yeah, we do need to praise them. And again, when Steven Gerrard left, it was possible to think that Rangers would just return to the old scenario of battling out with Celtic, and they'd gone through a sort of glamour phase that was now over. So they've done really well to progress and to make a name for themselves in this competition, and they should be more prominent than they have been in Europe, even on their resources. You know, with a name like that, I think the fans need it. The Scottish duopoly of Rangers and Celtic is great, but ultimately it has to have a European dimension for it to translate outside that country. And you know, and Rangers are taking it outside the borders.
Yeah. Do you think, you know, clubs from those sort of mid-table leagues or mid-table clubs from bigger leagues like Bundesliga, are these clubs, Frankfurt, Leipzig to a degree, are they likely to be victims, do you think, Aid, of this UEFA reform of the Champions League, so-called reform, which is going to give two places to, you know, frankly, unqualified but bigger clubs?
Yeah, I don't like it. I must admit, I don't like the feeling behind it. We all know it's a sort of peace offering, isn't it, to those big clubs that were threatening to break away from the Super League. It's sort of a compromise call, isn't it? I don't think anyone from a sporting integrity point of view would welcome this at all. One thing I would praise them for is the Conference League. I've been really surprised by it. Mm. I think that and the Europa League now, obviously we used to have three European competitions with the Cup Winners' Cup. I think bringing back a third was a really smart move, and it's enlivened so many mid-ranking clubs across Europe, because football's all about winning, isn't it? It's about that possibility to win silverware. And for clubs like, you know, Feyenoord as well, you know, looking at the Conference League, Roma less so, but a Leicester, it's given them a chance to win a European trophy. I think it's been a very welcome introduction. A little bit like the Nations League as well. I thought that's worked out quite well as well. So a little bit of praise for those calls, but no thanks to these two sort of places that they're gifting to the bigger clubs. That's wrong in my opinion.
Mm, yeah, well, Paul and I go back to the Intercities Fairs Cup, probably, don't we? Leicester, Paul, you know, 1-1 in Rome. It was interesting. Tammy Abraham, who has, let's be honest here, really seized the imagination and his opportunity in Rome. He was knocking on about Jose Mourinho being one of the best, and I think this is a direct quote, is one of the best coaches on the planet. If Rome will win the Conference League, he will see this obviously as a personal vindication. Is that justified?
Well, his record, if he just put his medals on the table, he wouldn't have much of a debate, would you, about whether he's a great manager. The question obviously has always been, is he still a great manager in the context of the way the game has developed? Is he a great manager for today, or is he a great manager for yesterday? Tammy Abraham thinks he's still a great manager, and but the move to Roma suggested, there was an element of ever-decreasing circles about that, wasn't there? It was a step down from the type of club that he's used to managing, and you wondered whether he would just... He'd just sort of fade into the background a bit, although he's, come to think of it, he's not very good at fading, is he? or being in the background, but you know what I mean? That he was just stepping down the rungs of what was a great coaching career. And it'll be very interesting to see whether he can revive that at Roma and show the world that, no, actually, he should be managing one of the top six clubs in Europe, because at the moment, none of those clubs would appoint him, I don't think, because it's too much trouble.
Yeah. What about Leicester, Aid? Probably fair to say they were the better team in the first leg, hit by a bit of a sucker punch. James Maddison, someone who divides opinion, to be charitable, he does seem to be fulfilling himself, doesn't he?
I like him. I do. I think he's a really nice player to watch. Obviously gifted, technically excellent. Yeah, he's sometimes slightly unpopular. He's a little bit flash, isn't he, James Maddison? He makes no apologies for that. But no, as a footballer, I want him to... I'm sort of willing him to fulfil his potential. And he's working with a good coach, isn't he, Brendan Rodgers? I rate him highly. He wants to play attacking football. And I'll credit James Maddison, because earlier on in the season, he was out of the side. They couldn't really find a place for him. He was a little bit out of sorts. He didn't have a position that worked for him within the framework that Brendan Rodgers wanted. And he could have kicked off. He could have sulked. He could have angled for a move, but he didn't. He kind of just knuckled down, did a bit less media, and concentrated on his football. And I think he's a better player for it. What I think the key difference for him in recent months is maybe he's getting coming deeper less, but making more impact inside the final third. So he's probably having less touches of the ball, but the touches that he's having are more decisive than they were, and that shows a little bit of maturity on his part, and credit as well to Leicester for developing a role that suits him.
Yeah, one thing that struck me watching that first leg, Paul, was the performance of Wes Fofana. I suppose it's inevitable that you think, it's one of those if-only observations here. What would Leicester's season have looked like had he been fit for the duration?
Better, I'm certain of that. He's a complete prodigy. I think every club in Europe will be looking at him as a bedrock centre-back, potentially a kind of... No, I won't start throwing names like Virgil van Dijk in. That's just silly. There's no need to. But you know what I mean? I think he's top level. He's ability-wise. And it was a pretty grievous blow when Leicester lost him.
True. This is the final point, gents. It seems that momentum is building for the two-legged Champions League semi-finals, which, let's face it, have been a real success, to be scrapped and a so-called week of football in a single city implemented. And there's some talk that this could well be introduced in the 24-25 season. I suppose a simple question for both of you, please. Good or bad thing?
Shall I go first? I'll go first because I think I'm going to sit on the fence. I genuinely don't know how I feel about it, because I can see the pros and the cons. We've just had... As Paul said earlier on in the show, some of the best two-legged Champions League ties in living memory. Just phenomenal. We haven't even mentioned, I think, Real Madrid PSG was phenomenal as well. Two-legged ties
are awesome when you've got this level of football and teams that want to play attack-minded football. So I'd be loath to change it. But at the same time, I think fans, you know, would quite like the opportunity to go and enjoy the experience of following their side to you know, foreign city, to go and watch them in a big semi-final, and then potentially to stick around for a final a few days later. I think the fact from a fan's experience, it might be quite special. So I'm torn. I personally wouldn't change it. I don't think there's a need for the change, but in the same breath, I might enjoy watching it. and it would be one less game, you know, obviously. And players these days, they can't handle it, can they? They need less football. We keep being told that.
Yeah, absolutely. And when, you know, it was tried in the Nations League, Paul. What do you feel?
Well, I just look at the games we've just seen and ask myself why anybody would want to change that system when it's so good. I mean, we've all been intoxicated by these games, so why mess around with that? And then you wonder what the motivations are for, you know, having a week of football in a single city. It feels like an attempt to create a kind of pseudo mini tournament. The reasons for which can only be commercial. If they wanted to save the players a game, they could remove it somewhere else. They don't need to remove one of these legs of a semi-final. Of course, the beauty of the semi-finals being home and away is they create this wonderful jeopardy and this tension and this anticipation between the first game and the second. All you can do is review the first game and wonder how the second game is going to unfold. And then when you get to the second game, it's a completely different challenge in a completely different stadium. And it's fascinating. So I cannot see why you would mess with that.
Yeah, I can understand that argument. I suppose if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But, you know, it might be an unpopular opinion, but I can see the positives in the change. As Aid alluded to there, the modern schedule is unsustainable. It's going to shorten players' careers, and it probably risks shortchanging the fans. That's not to excuse the original motivation for this idea, which, as Paul said, is, let's be honest, money. What do you think? I have a hunch that this debate might run and run. In the meantime, thanks to Adrian and to Paul for their insights. And thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.